anything more about what I was going to read is because I didn't tell her what I was going to read, because when James asked me to do this 6 months ago, in a moment of madness, he said, would you do some reading? And I said yes, and he said, what would you like to read from? And I said, oh, 6 months' time, I'll read from my new novel. And it seemed at the time quite a nice thing to do, because I was working with the MA students at Birkbeck, and lots of them had shown me their work in progress, and it's a very vulnerable making thing to do. And it seemed only fair enough to put myself in the firing line and allow them a chance to get their own back at me at some point. And I also thought it'd be good for me to have a deadline. And also, 6 months away seemed quite far enough away not to worry about it at all, and so it didn't matter what I promised too much. And then last week, James said, so, you know, you're going to read from your new novel, and I thought, shit.
I said it nice.
You did say it very nicely, yeah. And I've kind of had this very interesting week of working out what to do, because I have a kind of philosophy that when you're writing something, at least when I'm writing my work, I like to keep things really fluid for pretty much the whole time, so that I can change things all the way through. And it doesn't, it's a bit like making a jelly or something. It doesn't become set really until it's kind of ready to go off to the agent or whatever, or to a friend or whoever it is who's going to see it at the end. And I have, there are other people, other writers who are like this, I think, too. It's not just me who likes ripping my work up at regular intervals halfway through and three quarters of the way through. Because I once heard a great quote from Michael Ondaatje, who writes quite in a very fragmentary way, isn't he? And he said that he never knew whether a novel was going to work until he was about three quarters of the way through it. Which I think, considering, apparently it takes 4 to 5 years to write a novel, so it's a long time to be writing in the dark and holding out, keeping the faith on something. So, and he has this nice line. I think I may have read this to some of you before, I can't remember, but he has this nice line in The Skin of a Lion, which is one of his books that I really like. And it's kind of encouraging the reader to hang in there because of this non-linear approach he sometimes has with his fiction. And it goes, the first sentence of every novel should be, trust me. This will take time, but there is order here, very faint, very human. Meander if you want to get to town. And I think that I love that meander if you want to get to town bit particularly, because it seems, I mean, that's not just a description of the reading process, it's very much a description to me of the writing process and the need to kind of trust in what you're doing, and even if it doesn't make sense yet, it may well do one day. But that's very much as the people I've worked with at Birkbeck will testify to, it's very much my way of working, a sort of meandering sort of way. And then during this week I thought, actually, you know, this deadline business, actually I think deadlines are really quite bad. And it's all very well when you're doing an MA, it's quite good to have deadlines because it makes you pull your finger out and it makes you do something. And but the really important lesson, I was thinking, and I can set a good example for my Birkbeck students here, is that once you leave and you don't have any deadlines anymore, it's not a thing to be anxious about. Because what happens then is that you put your process first, okay? So if you need to meander, if you need to take 2 steps forward and 6 steps back in order to take 1 step forward, that's what you have to do. And if there's a deadline coming up that is making you feel the need to polish your prose before it's really ready to be polished, or make it make sense before it actually really is ready to make sense, then you should say, fuck the deadline, I'm not going to do it, okay? So I thought, okay, well, I'll set an example by telling James, fuck that, I'm not going to do that. And so that was kind of where I was at last week, and thinking, okay, I'll read from something that I've already published and all this sort of stuff, and then that will put, anyway. And then what happened? I had this very weird thing that happened, which is that I was reading the collected letters of Raymond Chandler, which are really good, and he has this... he had this brilliant rule when he was writing, which was that he had to sit down at his writing desk by 9 a.m, and he had to stay there for at least 4 hours, but that he didn't have to write if he didn't feel like it, which I thought was brilliant. But he couldn't do anything else. He couldn't read, he couldn't write a letter, he couldn't go for a walk or anything. He just had to be there. And kind of after a while, I think probably what happens is that if you're going to be there anyway and there's something else to do, then you might as well write, because it's more interesting to write than not to write. So having decided that I wasn't obliged to read from my new book, and that there was absolutely no pressure on me to read from my new book, and that I didn't want to read from my new book, I then discovered that I did quite want to read from my new book. So that's kind of what happened. And what I decided is that the novel is got various different voices in, and I've got a novel within the novel, which is that one of the characters is reading a novel, and you don't realise at the very beginning that this is what's going on. You don't realise that it's a novel that one of them's reading, but you do realise that after a while. And it's not that this novel influences the character into a particular course of action or anything, but her experience of it colours her experience of everything else that's going on. And I kind of got into that idea because I thought, you know, when you are reading a novel and you are very caught up in it, you do carry it around in your head, don't you? And in a way, it does colour whatever's happening over the week that you're reading it or the 2 weeks that you're reading it. So I thought it was kind of nice, and it does pertain to the action in some way. It's a kind of slightly different angle on things. So I'm going to read you the beginning of the novel within the novel, which gets me out of telling you what the novel's about. He backed the bike out of the garage and bumped it roughly over the stony drive, kicked out a stand and left it perched while he went back inside. He came out pulling on a worn leather jacket with the shine knocked out of it and carrying a silver helmet which he clamped down over his untidy grey mop, pulled the chin strap tight. It was early in the morning and there was a bite in the air. He slung his leg over the bike and rubbed his hands and blew into their hollow. Then he remembered something else and propped the bike again and went back inside. This time he came out with a pair of large leather gloves which doubled the size of his hands. The engine's splutter rose up the scale. It had to get to just the right note, and he waited for it, without particularly knowing that that was what he was doing. The sky was big and pale, and the line of trees on the edge of the field were black stripes, with the early sun glinting out in fractures from behind. The right note sounded. He stuck it in gear and took off. 30 seconds later, he skidded to a halt on the gravel, got off, propped the bike on its stand a third time, and left the bike grumbling. He went back in and came out with another helmet, a black one, which he placed on the rear rack and pulled elasticated ropes over it. It was a long time since he'd had to think about someone else. He wiggled the helmet with his hand to make sure it was secure, then slung his leg over and revved again and took off. The engine's drone rose up and he let the note climb, then switched the gear and let it climb again. I'm going to skip a bit where he's just going on this journey, which is along the south coast of England. He stopped in Worthing and bought an egg and cress sandwich in a plastic package from the newsagents, the bread curling at the corners. He ate it walking down the street, startling himself in the black window of a shop. His legs were bandy as a cowboy's, his hair squashed flat to his ears, then sticking out in greasy tufts. Jesus! He straightened up, raked a hand through the hair. A few doors down was a barber's. Before the door had even closed behind him, the barber was blowing the hairs off a razor and moving in on him. He scissored it roughly, then mowed him in rows like a lawn. With every row, a new silver cap was stitched to his scalp. Loic ran his hand over the new bristle. Passing through? Yes. Where to? Folkestone, the ferry. Going over? No, picking up. Your wife? My son. Ah, you have a son. How old is he? 17. Mine too. Plays the bloody guitar. Electric, all amped up. It's driving the rest of us crazy. My wife's already gone crazy. The barber waited for Loic to chip in with a story of his own, but Loic didn't have any stories about his son. Ah, you have a good son, a quiet son, said the barber. Well brought up. When the barber was finished, Loic splashed his face with cold water at the sink and wiped it dry on the barber's towel. Back on the bike, he sat there for a while before he put his helmet on, letting the cool air discover his scalp. At Folkestone, he jumped up and walked along the harbour walls, the black sea slopped up against them. The rigging of boats clipped and knocked. Smile, he thought. Hug him. You'll have to hug him. There was a lump in his throat and he kept clenching and unclenching his fists. He marched up and down the harbour area waiting to see the hulk of a ferry appear over the edge of the world. He was all expectation. It made him stiff as a board. He didn't know the exact time the ferry was due, except that it was early evening. He supposed he should have checked this. Had he even got the right day? He didn't like talking to Penelope for longer than he had to. Loic went over to the terminal building and picked up a schedule, but he couldn't make much sense of it. Then people started arriving. A man in an orange boiler suit organised the cars into rows. Loic unzipped his jacket and lay down on the harbour wall. Then he got up and walked around again. A ferry was growing like a swarm of bees on the horizon. When it looked halfway close, he decided he needed to put something in his belly again, and he marched down an ugly street with luggage shops and 24-hour supermarkets. He ate a dry croissant in a cafe, washed it down with a sour black coffee that made his bowels burn. Then he sat for 10 minutes on a seatless toilet out the back, a cold draught blowing on his buttocks, staring at a pale pink wall and a can of air freshener. By the time he got back, half the cars had already boarded. There was no sign of any disembarked passengers. "I'm looking for a boy," he told a group of dockers. "About 17, by himself. He's French." His eyes fell to the rope, thick as a wrist, wound around one man's shoulder. "Can I see that?" said Loic. Men who liked ropes always recognised one another. He should have been hurrying off to find the boy, but instead here he was discussing a rope with a docker. "Try the bus station," the docker said finally. Loic got back on his bike. He drove past the bus station and pulled over and looked back. He was standing, looking up at the bus stop sign, hands thrust down his front jeans pocket, T-shirt skewed by the wind. Tall, all angles, a triangle of pale, fine hair sent sideways. He had Penelope's boniness. In fact, it could have been her from the side all those years ago, elbows pointing out like broken umbrella spokes on some rain-slick pavement, waiting for him to show up. He saw a shiver run through the kid like a current, shoulder to hip, as he approached. He looked half frozen. She hadn't dressed him properly. A ripple of old anger flared in his chest. Here she was sabotaging the whole thing before it had even started. And who said anything about him having to get a bus? Guarded eyes checked him out through slats of fringe. The eyes were his, flint grey, wary. They knew one another from the eyes. "T'es venu me chercher en moto?" This was a shock to Loic. In all the imagined conversations they'd had over the years, the boy had always spoken English. "What's wrong with that?" The boy looked at him, then jerked his head at a large suitcase standing on the pavement. "What did you bring with you, the family china? Well, open it up, let's see what you've got." The kid hesitated, then pulled the case onto its side and flicked the catches. It wasn't as tightly packed as it could have been, but there were plenty of warm clothes, stacks of jumpers. "Put these on." Loic tugged out what looked like a bomber jacket, a long-sleeved T-shirt. He flung them at the boy. He left him standing there with all his belongings exposed and went back to the bike. The engine was warm and didn't need waiting for, but he waited anyway. He swallowed. He was doing it all wrong, but it was all he could do. He drew a graceful half-circle back to the boy. He lifted the hatch of one of the panniers. The boy watched, trying to pretend he wasn't interested, but he was. Loic yanked out his own small, soft bag. Then he grabbed a handful of clothes from the suitcase and thrust them down inside the pannier. The kid's lip quivered. Loic went back for another handful. It was either a quiver or a twitch. "Mais tu te fous, ça?" "Speak in English." He took out another stack of neatly folded shirts and thrust them in. "Mais t'es en train de tout froisser là." "Doesn't matter," he said. "You don't have to look smart for anywhere we're going. Anyway, what else do you suggest?" The next thing he pulled out was something made of silk, lime green, long-sleeved. "Where the hell were you planning to wear this?" The boy hesitated. "C'est maman qui m'a l'acheté," he said. "For the climbing." Loic looked at the boy, saw his Adam's apple bob up, then down, then up again. He stuffed the silk shirt in the pannier with everything else. "There's a gents over there," he said. The boy hesitated, then walked off with the extra clothes balled against his chest. On the far side of the car park was a big black bin. Loic flicked the locks on the empty suitcase and took it over and flung it in. He came back and waited near the bike. "All set," Loic muttered when the boy appeared, his jacket zipped all the way up. He helped him with the helmet, feeling a fine fuzz on the boy's chin as he tightened the strap. The ferry blared loudly behind their backs. He had thought about what he could say. He could tell them how far they had to go, what the long-term forecast was for the summer, about the hills where he lived. But it was too hard turning round and shouting through the helmet, and the boy probably wouldn't understand it all. They skirted the town and were soon out in the countryside. Loic hoped he would be drinking in the greenness of everything, the thatched houses, the hand-painted pub signs, all the English things he wouldn't have seen before. The cleanness of the lambs with their two big ears, stopping to stare at this angry machine, then skittering off to ram their faces into their mother's udders, as if they didn't have lambs in France. He stopped once for petrol, a bottle of water for them both. The boy knew to wait until he was told before getting on and off. Which of the litany of father figures in his life had taught him that, Loic wondered. All the way back along the coast road, through the fields, through the seaside towns. He knew the boy was probably hungry, but he pressed on because he didn't know what to suggest they ate, or where they would eat it, or how he would cope with sitting across from him over a table. For the whole journey back, he was aware of him, of the thighs clamped tight around his thighs, the arms encircling his trunk. He felt every adjustment, every nuance in their contact. It was a chance to get the measure of him, his weight, his sense of balance, his nerve. He was aware of him while they waited for an old man to cross the road, lifting his loaf of bread in acknowledgement, the boy sitting back and relaxing his grip. He was aware of him every time they took a bend, their torsos melding together. He wanted the bends to go on and on. He wanted to never arrive. It was like the touch of a lover at night, the lights off, not needing to speak or smile. And when something bounded out from a steep hedgerow, hooves, a splattered flank, a frantic eye, an impossibly big leap across the road, it was the boy he was scared for. Grip, he thought, hold on. He slammed on the brakes and the back wheel scudded, bouncing on the tarmac like a skimmed stone, and the boy grabbed a fistful of Loic's leather jacket, right up near the throat, and twisted it. Are you okay? No sound, not a peep. That's my son, all right, thought Loic. He sat there a while before moving off, the engine running, needing to catch his breath, to feel the little heart firing off against his back ribs.